Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan Renshaw from up where the clouds don't go. You're above the clouds, Dan.
You know, today was just a beautiful morning. Gosh, I looked out my window and there's the decrescent moon and there's Venus and they're right above Palmer and looked like some kind of an idyllic setting. Gosh, beautiful, clear, beautiful night.
Okay.
And warm. I'm inverted by about 5 degrees up there, so whatever you are, I'm warmer than. It was a nice trip down the mountain.
Okay, well, very, very, very good. So we're going to pick up the story. And we had done we'd gone from the cliff.
Oh my, we've been struggling around on Skyscraper Mountain, which, again, let's go into the visitor center.
Okay, that's oriented. A good place.
And we'll exit the visitor center. It takes us out to the higher parking lot at the Independence Mine State Historical Park. And let's stand there in the middle of that parking lot and turn west. And we're looking at two mountains, Skyscraper Mountain and Granite Mountain. And between the two, there's a very interesting rock glacier. And a general name of that depression is called Carl Gulch. We had kind of finished up on Skyscraper Mountain. I'd made the comment that everything had been kind of suspended. The effort of this outrageous character, Billy Martin. Martin had quite a reputation of being a really difficult guy to work for. He ran a camp that was so primitive, wall tents, spring, summer, and fall, and then winter, they're all out of there. This is just a summer operation.
Right.
But he had a mess tent that was the only semi-permanent facility, and it was bacon and beans and moose meat, and boy, anybody heard complaining was sent down the mountain, and he was a tough guy to work for. He was all business. And again, Billy is a self-trained mining person. He is an attorney out of Seattle. But he does wonderfully well in his 8 years that he's on the property. And he gets his name attached to a lot of other properties around the mining district. He was involved everywhere. But we finished up with Mr. Martin. Now, his tenure ran from, he started in 1908 as far as having an attachment to the property. But he then finally left, let's see, it was 08, it was 12. He was there and actually until 20. He went through the war years and he was able to do his milling where he got his 22,000 tons through his Chilean mill, and made about 28,000 ounces. At the same time, now, I've asked everybody to shift your view a little bit to the right, and instead of looking at Skyscraper Mountain, let's look at the next mountain north, which is called Granite Mountain. And we've been there before. We've hiked up to the top of Granite Mountain and found it to be this triangular-shaped plateau of sorts, with the base being the ridge line that we're looking at Granite Mountain, and the apex being what's called Bullion Ridge, which runs west. And out on that ridge, we discussed the Bullion Mine. But for right now, we're looking midway up the mountain, and we notice a large dump, a mining waste pile called the 900 level. And it was the primary level for the secondary, what would I call it, the after World War I development that came when the price of gold was adjusted in the 30s. But when we go up there in that area and examine the 900, we'll also see a 700 and several other smaller dumps. You can't see them very well from down below. You got to get up there higher. And those other dumps are the ones that were prior to World War I. So, well, Martin is struggling to come to terms with what he wants to do at Skyscraper, a guy named Carl, and we've talked about Carl quite a bit.
Right.
Mainly the Carl Wagon Road. When you drive on the Wasilla Fishhook Road, why, you're pretty much following the Carl Wagon Road. That's why you can't pass anybody. It wanders all over the place, yet to be straightened out. We'll come back to the Carl Wagon Road in a future story here. I've got some wonderful stories that have to do with early day travel in and out of the mining district. And the Carl Wagon Road had a world-class mud hole in it.
Oh,
but
okay.
We'll come back to that.
All right.
So you've got Carl, and he shows up. He's the local representative for a group of investors, and they get an option on the Granite Mountain claims owned by the Barthoff family. And the Barthoffs made the discovery, Independence Vein up high, the Granite Mountain vein midway on the mountain. And they also, at the same time, had discovered the bullion mine, which was far richer, and they elected to do the development of the bullion and then lease option the other properties. So this group that took it sent Carl up to do the investigation. Carl found that he needed a road to get his milling equipment in. Now, this was 1908 to 1911, and he brings in a prospecting mill, a stamp mill, and he locates it right where the current Independence Mine mill is located. He sets it up there. There's some people would call it a kind of a broken waterfall that comes over the cirque at that point. There's enough head there anyway that he can run a Pelton wheel. So he builds a dam up above to collect the water from Fisher Creek. And he runs this mill, and we had mentioned that he was so proud that the first year, 1908, he actually got a little bit of ore through it. He made 87 ounces. Mm-hmm. It was a bit of a joke. Next year, 09, he brings in, and he's got this three-stamp mill, and these stamps are 500-pound stamps. And he brings in then, and I can't imagine how he fashioned this into his mill. He's got a single 1,250-pound stamp, which, you know, this stuff is huge, and you're moving it by hand, necessarily. Jeez. Anyway, he gets this installed, and he probably can do like 8 tons a day then, a 24-hour day. But he's mining on the 700 level, what later becomes the 700 level of the Independence, and he's in some moderately good ore. He's also way up high on the original Independence vein, which later is pretty well determined to be an extension of the Martin operation on Skyscraper Mount, same vein. He does some mining up there and has a long tram line, very steep, to bring ore down to his mill. So he's milling from both there and the lower Granite Mountain vein. It's the biggest problem in a multi-year operation is show me. He goes back to his investors needing more money, and they say, show me why we should give you more money. And the third year was his last year. He couldn't come up with sufficient proof that this was worth carrying on. So they quit. Now, the mill is there in 1911, 1912, Billy Martin shows up, and he uses Carl's mill to begin with because it takes him quite a while to build his own mill.
Mm-hmm.
And what Martin is mainly interested in is these plating tests, and we've talked about that to a great extent. After Carl leaves, a guy by the name of Milo Kelly, and we don't know a lot about Milo at he's just got an address of Kinnick, and he lives in Kinnick. He gets together a group of investors that includes some interesting people. One of them, when you go to Seward these days, there's still the Brown and Hawkins hardware store, a general store. And the Hawkins, Brown and Hawkins, was involved in a lot of mining all over Alaska. And he gets involved in this group with Milo Kelly. So there's a group of Alaskans, and Kelly is the one that comes up. But Kelly spends a little bit of time on the Independence vein and the Granite Mountain vein, but mainly he expends himself on this long, long adit we talked about last time we met, over in the upper Willow Valley, and it heads to the east underneath Skyscraper Mountain. And he's determined he's going to find the down dip extension of the Skyscraper vein. Well, he, after 1,000 feet of tunnel, all done the hard way, he has to give up. He can't find it. Well, he didn't understand the geology. There's this huge Martin Fault. Oftentimes when you stand at the parking lot, the lower parking lot at the Independence Mine State Historic Park, the one at the end of road maintenance in the winter, you look up toward the Independence and you see Snowslide Gulch. I mean, this thing produces lots of snowslides. There was an early one this fall that was quite spectacular. But that gulch is Martin Fault, and it's a huge feature, and it displaced the vein, and that's one reason why Kelly didn't find it. But Kelly expends himself. It takes him quite a while. It's 1911 to 1914 that Kelly is working on the property. He then is followed in tune with a fella last name Robe, R-O-B-E. And Robe comes in, and he spends 1914 to 1916 on the property. And in 1916, Robe is convinced that this is going to be something big. And so he heads to the East Coast for financing. And he, when he leaves, he's telling everybody he's going to be back and he's going to bring a 40-stamp mill. Now, 40 stamps, if they're 1,000-pound stamps, and they're probably good for 3 tons a day, that's a 120-ton mill. This is a substantial operation that he has planned. But 1916, remember the Guns of August started in 1914 with the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, and suddenly we involve ourselves in World War One, and it is hot and heavy over in the European area, and we stay out of it for a while, but then various things drag us in. So here's Robe. He's back east, and he's promoting this mining operation, and it's bad timing because 1916, we're slipping into involvement in World War One. He can't put it together, and that pretty much is going to be the end of things at the Independence Mine for quite a while. It's going to be pretty quiet up there for the next almost 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just amazing. See, now remember, we've talked to the point of probably ad nauseum here about this big crash in the population of Alaska, built up tremendously after 1910 with the advent of the railroad and other projects going on. And then World War One, there was an absolute crash. Population of Alaska, mainly populated by young men. They all take off involvement in the war. So they didn't come back. And the only wheel that turned in the property that later became the Independence Mine was the involvement of the family of Bill Horning and his partner Charlie Barthoff at the Goldcorp Mine. Now, all the while this is going on, in 1915, the gold cord is discovered. And then in 1916, development starts. And we've touched on the gold cord before, how the combination of, a very durable combination of William Horning and his wife Pearl and Charlie Barthoff, and they sell out the Goldcorp mine to this promoter by the name of Smith, and they leave. And we've talked about them over at the War Baby mine and the discovery of the Lucky Shot and all of that. They finally wander back to the Gold Court and are there in the early 30s, redeveloping the Gold Court. And at that time, Charlie is so fascinated with the what was formerly known as the Granite Mountain vein that they visit with the owners of those claims down in Seattle. And they have a handshake agreement that they can do some mining on those claims. And this is going to lead me into this group of stories that I want to pursue next, having to do with a young boy named by the name of Alan Horning. He's the son of William and Pearl. We talked about he was born in Seattle because his mother wanted him to be president. Do you remember
that? Sure, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
And anyway, when they finally come back to the area, we talked about how Bill Horning had heard the Muckluck telegraph and he's mining at Council, and he made the rush to the Iditarod and he got the mining claims. We talked about getting him then to connect, and he becomes the town blacksmith.
Right.
And so on. And then finally we got him up to the Gold Court. So they then, I have, I took a lot of time to go out of my way to visit with Alan Horning, who was this young kid growing up in the Willow Creek Mining District, and visit him in his retirement years. And oh my gosh, talk about full of stories and good stories, good stuff. And he tells the story that one day in the, it must have been 1936, they're working on the Granite Mountain vein, midway up Granite Mountain, which is late, at this point, we might as well change the name officially because it becomes known as the Independence Vein. But they're mining. They've got a cable stretched from there over to the Gold Court Mill, and they're hauling ore down, and they're milling it. And one day, this somebody shows up on the property and says, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we're mining."
Mining,
and
right.
This guy says, "Get off my property." And they, "Whoa, what?" And unbeknownst to them, to Horning and Barthoff, we have a case where a corporation was formed called the Alaska Pacific Consolidated, and they had made a official paper copy type thing of options on the Skyscraper Mountain claims and the Granite Mountain claims. And they came up there knowing that there had been this handshake agreement, and guess what? It didn't hold up because the paper trumped the handshake, and so suddenly these guys are rudely awakened to the fact that they can't mine on the Independence anymore. But this, let's stop there with the development of the Independence, because Mike, I'd really like to go back there this summer.
Okay. And I look forward to it.
Yeah. We can do some on-site recording of what came then with the latter development of the Independence in the mid 1930s until the war closure, which was very complicated. And then they ran for a while after the war also.
So the Independence Mine, when people think about it, I think, myself included, I have this idea there was the Independence Mine. Someone discovered it, they worked it, then it stopped.
Yeah, and which would be more of the normal, yeah, but my, this thing had fits and starts and stops and backups, and it was pretty amazing. Robe, for example, if he had been successful, if it hadn't been for World War One, we'd have a wholly different kind of an operation that had taken place at the Independence. But isn't it interesting how the fickle finger of fate here?
Mm-hmm. Or if it had been just a little bit earlier in 1912 or 13 when he approached people for financial support. Yeah, just a little, just yeah. All that just the timing.
Bit, yeah. Yeah, just a little. And some of these adits, now remember that an adit is half a tunnel. In other words, when you go clear through a mountain, you've got two portals.
Okay.
That's a tunnel.
Right.
So until you go clear through the mountain, it's technically called an adit. So the mountain's full of adits up there where there's these
people
holes that poked in. They're horizontal. Several of them on the Independence vein, the lower vein that became the Independence, were just above this enormous ore zone. Excuse me, they just missed it, you know. Oh, my gosh. So if they'd been a few feet lower and ran that in, it would have been, you know,
so
bonanza time.
Okay, so we're back in the day, and you know, because you have some underground work that shows a vein going in sort of a certain direction, and then you sort of extrapolate from that, and you step back, and you say, okay, so if it continues on, I'll put this next opening about here. Is that the way it worked?
Yeah. For the most part, these are not geologists or mining people as far as being educated that way. It's all the hard knocks school. And so they read the signs as best they can and decide where they're going to put their tunnel. And it gets altered a little bit because you want to put it right there, but you can't because there's a big snow slide gulch right there. So you got to move it over there. And that means that when you go in, you've got to turn and go this way in order to try to find the vein and hope that you get on the right vein. And it's never easy. It's just never really straightforward. But these different holes in the wall up there are all, it takes a long time to describe them all and to, but we'll do that.
Is it just as a quick, a sort of aside in some respects to jump forward, you've described in some good detail the operation, how people would do work using a drill or a lot of manual labor. Just a question today, if someone were doing a tunnel or a hole into the side, would it be much easier because of all the equipment that we presumably have?
Oh, yes, enormously much easier, Mike. Excuse me. We had just barely touched on the art of hand drilling.
Right.
All of this prior to World War I, it was all hand drilling. When the end of the day came and you had your holes in the mountain and you put dynamite in them and you blasted the area, and you went down the hill, you had a heavy pack because you had to take with you all of those now dull drill steels. And then you'd have to take them down to the blacksmith if you had one, or you were the blacksmith.
Right.
And you had to resharpen them and retemper them, and then next day haul them back up the hill. And this is a substantial part of the labor involved in all of this. It's interesting that in more than one case, there is veins that get the name, usually blacksmith vein, you know, mm-hmm. type thing. What happens is, looking for a place to make kind of a little blacksmith shop up near the portal, you'd find some kind of an inflection in the mountainside. Well, it's got a little flat spot there because there's a vein there that you didn't know about. So in the process of digging out to try to make a location to have the blacksmith shop moved up there, guess what? You'd discover another vein, see? So there's more than one of those. They're inconsequential. They're never veins that made any real ore, but it's still fascinating.
Sure, sure.
But a lot of times they'd move the blacksmith shop up there so that they could be closer. They didn't have to haul everything up and down the hill every day.
Wow.
All of this was so enormously labor intensive. Today, you can't find men that'll work like that.
Well, okay.
We're spoiled mentally, you know. We know
well, that. If not physically. I
mean. Yeah, nobody's interested in working that hard. And then at the end of the day, come down to a wet sleeping bag and a wall tent and eat moose meat and beans. And this was, you didn't live to a ripe old age those days.
Well, we have a few minutes left. Do you have anything to finish as we've brought this up to World War One?
No, that's about it for the independence. And again, we're drawing this line roughly at World War One.
Okay.
And it'll be continued then with the after World War One developments that came. World War One was the first real industrial war. It did enormous things to expand and develop the Industrial Revolution in America, especially worldwide. But there was an upgrade not only in the capacity to produce the war material and everything supporting it, but the quality also, for example, metallurgy, to make metals that would do more. And this doing more was important because then you could use less. It was stronger material, more durable material. And we learned then how to make, for example, reciprocating drills run by compressed air that were light enough that they made sense to use them.
Okay.
A lot of developments like that. So, we're going to go into this hibernation period of about 20 years, and we'll pick that up later. But then this coming session, Mike, where I'd like to go is some of these stories that were told by Alan Horning.
Ah, wonderful.
The young boy that grew up and all of his impressions.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mike.